question which I hear peeking out, which is, what is a fundamental law? That is, and just in this exchange with Bob Wald, I mean, Bob, you know, the point you're making is that we often take general relativity as the fundamental law. We give it, we bow down to it, and then we start computing in something which is sort of made up in thin air, which is not consistent with general relativity, but consistent with what we might do. So there is actually here a failure of explanatory from the base, blah, 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 but it's not an explanation of the kind you would want to call, we wouldn't want to call orbits as emergent phenomenon. Sorry, I think.
Right, so in this, so in my talk I was regarding GTR as an effective theory and thinking about emergence as a claim about phenomena at one level relative to a base level account or model, where the base level account is not fundamental. I think if you think about the base level account as a fundamental theory, then the physicist's approach becomes much, much more interesting and important, because I think this gets back to what some of the previous speakers, like Gordon Ballot, were talking about. In that case, then it's really interesting that the upper level description contains phenomena or properties that aren't in the fundamental theory. That's actually maybe something physicists
would
not expect.
Is that the reason for the philosophical interest in the notion of emergence, that there can be a notion of a fundamental theory which, in spite of the fact that we call it fundamental, fails to even describe some phenomenon which we believe exists in the world that fundamental theory describes?
Let me give you my answer. It'll be different than Margie's. My answer is no. The philosophical interest in emergence is based on trying to trace the arrows of explanation within our current physics. So it's interesting if, and those are explanations from one effective theory to another, maybe a more general effective theory. So there the interest in emergence is, well, can all the phenomena be explained in terms of a micro basis, exclusively in micro terms? And if not, well, that's interesting, why not? So nothing to do with whether it's fundamental.
I'm so confused when people are saying, can that be explained on the micro basis? I mean,
right.
So if you have something that can't be explained on the micro basis, then either the micro basis is wrong and you should be looking for another different fundamental theory, or the methods are inadequate. But I mean, that isn't what we're talking about with superconductivity or any of the other examples that have been given. So what do you mean by can't be explained? If you mean it can't be explained easily in terms of you know, positions and velocities of individual particles or something like that, of course not. But if you mean really can't be explained, then, you know, that's telling you that either we don't have methods and we're guessing, or it's telling you that what was proposed as the fundamental theory is wrong and we got to start over again and look for a fundamental theory.
Yeah, so one example would be the your comment on the effective field theory application here. So the effective field theory application is inconsistent with general relativity. So you might say, well, using those methods, you can't explain these time-dependent phase we might observe based on exclusively on general relativity. So that would be a failure explanation.
I'd like to point out that the question was actually asked to all of us.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Well, I think, you know, there's a general confusion about this notion of can't be explained. Because in the example I used, you can explain the Meissner effect and infinite conductivity from the BCS theory. But then the question is, well, how is it that you're explaining it? And it turns out that you're explaining it because the models embody a breakdown of electromagnetic gauge invariance plus a bunch of other things. But the other things turn out not to be crucial for the derivation of the so-called emergent properties. So there is an explanation in the sense that, and also I think in the renormalization group shows us, is that you start at the micro level, and then as you just scale up, the micro level becomes less and less important. But there is a story, a kind of evolution there from the microscopic physics up to the macroscopic level. So that's one of the reasons why I don't like the philosophical account of emergence, because I think it serves to kind of confuse us as to where the explanatory or what the explanatory roles are and where the explanations are located. So I don't know if that clarifies or confuses the point.
I still don't have, I mean, what is it that can't be, what is it about superconductivity that can't be explained from the microscopic theory?
Well,
or
I think,
from the more fundamental theory?
One thing, and then I'll go over to Phil. If you're serious about the issue related to deriving exact results from approximations, if you see that as a problem, then it becomes a case that you don't actually derive these exact results. What's the nature of the exactness in those results, the infinite conductivity, these things that are stable across all superconductors and don't depend on individual microscopic explanations? So it's the exact results from approximations that I see as the important problem with the explanatory link.
So I'd like to respond to Lee's question, which, in case you've forgotten it, was what is it that constitutes a fundamental law in all of this? And I think that one actually can compare and contrast the answers that philosophers would give to that with those of physicists. Actually, I don't think that the answers that you gave are all that different. I think that probably by now, a lot of people, even in string theory, would be prepared to accept that something like the quantum protectorate constitutes fundamental, maybe not a law, but it's pretty fundamental. I actually think that Margaret gave away too much before to a previous question of Lee's, because it's quite clear that the second law is a protectorate. It may not, in fact, it's more general than a quantum one. It's a one that none of us would ever believe would fail, and it's absolutely independent of the microscopic features. Mm. So it's as good as, if not better than, gauge invariance and so forth. And as an answer to Bob's question, well, there are lots of things that you can't calculate with superconductivity theory for a real system. She's only focusing on the things that can be derived from gauge invariance, which of course are derived from BCS theory as well. So, but finally, one can also ask not about fundamental laws, but fundamental explanations. And it seems to me that the philosophers and the physicists diverge enormously here. I mean, they're a million miles away from each other. So whenever I listen to a talk which claims to explain things using, for example, C-star algebra, something which I've never seen a physicist attempt to do, but for which some reason philosophers love to do, I despair, because I don't understand why they think that they're explaining anything, particularly as that C-star algebra doesn't apply to any real physical system. So this is, I think, the real divergence between physicists and philosophers. It's not so much in what they're considering to be laws, but explanations.
Oh, thank you. So first of all, I owe an apology. So during my talk, Nigel asked me whether it was really Anderson to say that the canonical example of emergence is the emergence of thermodynamics from statistical mechanics. And no, so actually, it's not. I just reread the paper, and the thesis is not in that paper. So I think it's a canonical example, but it was not Anderson. Nevertheless, having just reread the paper, I can say. So Anderson actually does an interesting distinction that somehow has been evocated by many, but in Rob Wall's last question. So he says that on the one hand, people do not think that condensed matter, many body theory, ordinary matter just obeys the laws of ordinary matter. And from this respect, if he didn't, then you would need a different fundamental theory to just mean that it's wrong. On the other hand, with some relevant exceptions, but typically you cannot use the fundamental laws to reconstruct many body theory. And typically you don't explain any material by first principles, even if there are some notable interesting examples. But typically also in the paper it says, the discoverer of the positron said that all the rest is applied chemistry. But it's not really like that. You really need to sometimes guess. There is a lot of guessing in understanding what is the right RG, or to guess what symmetry is being broken. And only after you guess that, then you're able to somehow see it in terms of the more fundamental laws. So I understand that condensed matter physics is also a little bit of an art at this point. And maybe I would like to ask everyone if you guys think that maybe this is part of what it means emergence, that there is not just something that you can plug in a computer, but you need some artistic sensitivity. No?
This is a question probably based on my terrible ignorance of this whole field, but I was thinking of the characterization given by Margie, which she doesn't like, and by Andrew, which he did sort of like. And this was based on derivability, explainability, and so on. But I, instead of a physical theory, let me just pick a math example, because we understand the relations between the premises, the principles of, in math, a lot better than we do in physics. So let's just take Euclidean geometry. If I started out with the first four postulates, you could not derive, expect, predict, et cetera, the fifth postulate. Would anyone say that that was an emergent fact or whatever? It doesn't seem right at all, right? So why not? Is there something wrong with the characterization of emergence, or is it something, or what really is going on is some intuitive conception of the underlying base and how it hangs together? And so an awful lot of the emphasis really must be on that and not so much on derivability or predictability or explainability and so on, right? So what on earth is going on? Now, I thought of another example. I'm afraid it's also from math, but maybe it's something like new concepts are arising. They don't arise in the fifth postulate case. But just take something like knot theory. So knot theory is about knots, closed loops in space. But most of knot theory is actually not about knots. It's about knot projections, two-dimensional projections. And then you get brand new concepts which are really interesting and useful, things like strands crossing, and you can get faces and so on, and you can prove an awful lot of stuff based on these concepts. So here's something that's really new and interesting, like a crossing number, which makes no sense for a knot in three-dimensional space, but makes a hell of a lot of sense in the two-dimensional projection. Is that emergence, like a crossing number, something like that? That's more interesting. I'm actually on the border on that one. I can't actually feel it one way or another, but I could be persuaded that's not emergence either. In which case, now I'm at a complete loss as to what might be going on, and it seems like that there's some intuitive notion of the underlying theory, and that's where all the action is, and it's got nothing to do with new concepts or derivability or anything else. And I don't know why it hangs together that way.
Well, I think I have one, yeah. And I think your example speaks more to issue about human creativity. I mean, do we call human creativity an emergent phenomena? Well, maybe, maybe not. But I think, I mean, my interest in emergence is with respect to actual physical things and the relationship between the physical thing and its micro constituents, and where that's different, explaining how it's different and why it's different and what the relationship between the two might be. So I think, you know, we can go down the path of calling lots of things emergent because they're new and novel, new concepts, new, you know, whatever you want to plug in there. But then I think therein lies the road to ruin, because then everything is emergent and then it ceases to lose meaning. So, it loses meaning. Yeah, that's what I meant. It loses meaning. So I think that's why I think that the focus on novelty and surprise and all of those other epistemological concepts, while they may be important, you need to look at what the source, why is it that this is novel, or why is it that this surprises us? And it's that that is going to constitute the explanation or part of the explanation of emergence.
I just make a quick comment on your first example. That's not emergence. That's a case where you have independent axioms of a theory. So for emergence to get started, to get off the ground, you need two levels. It's a description. It's a relational description about phenomena or properties at two levels. So if you had Euclid's five axioms and you had some feature of a plane closed figure that you couldn't derive from Euclid's five axioms or explain on that basis, okay, then you start to wonder whether it's emergent.
But I say in that case, you've got an intuitive level about what this is. Suppose right. I've got this new geometry. It's Euclid's five postulates plus the theory of evolution. And that's my underlying level. Now, give me an intuitive reason why.
Yeah. We've got a lot of questions.
Yeah. Well, you probably noticed that Lee has been asking the question, which I think is really important, that is, what would we call a fundamental law of physics or the micro level? And I actually wanted to ask the question again, which I raised the other day, which I think is due to Lee's question. And it has to do with what are the criteria that we have come up with to define something as a protectorate? It's just a big term. But at each level of effective field theory, we know for practitioners, you can do different ways of coarse graining and get different derived or effective theories. Some of them have real implications, you know, that it describes physical reality reproduced by experiments if we would be willing to adopt that kind of collective degrees of freedom, hydrodynamic variables and whatnot. For example, I actually had that question 10 or 15 years ago posed that to Leibowitz. And because between microphysics, right, molecular dynamics, and hydrodynamics or thermodynamics, I was asking, well, there must be other relatively stable structures, levels of structures and theories, right? And those are called kinetic theory. And what we learn in kinetic, in textbook, is just one very simplified form of it. Albeit it's a very powerful one, in fact, because it could look at the micro, it could also look at the macro. Leibowitz told me to talk to Spohn, and he actually wrote a whole book on that. And he told me that there could be many levels of relative stability in the kinetic theory regime. This is just an illustration. And so my question to physicists and philosophers all alike is, what are the criteria? I think that's actually more important to define this kind of stability.
I think that, personally, I thought that the answer that was given by Margot was a pretty good start at any rate. I mean, I think that the Pines-Laughlin paper was simply spelling out things that Anderson had already said. And to say that, you know, you've got some principle governing macroscopic systems, for example, which applies to a whole variety of them, independent of any microscopic details, interactions, laws, or whatever that might apply to those systems, is to say that you have a macroscopic law. Since I think most of us agreed here that, you know, there's really no fundamental difference between one level and another, you know, whether you happen to be at 10 to the 16 electron volts or 10 to the minus 16, they're, you know, all in the same infinite, then really there shouldn't be any difference in the way you formulate the idea of a law at those different levels. Oh, but that's a different question. Oh, sorry. So you're asking how do physicists find laws? I think, as Feyerabend said, anything goes.
Use experiment.
Well, could have, I'm not sure that he really distinguished them.
I've got Nigel, Bob, and even Bill in the queue, so let's keep the
attention. Okay, so I have a quick comment on Margaret's talk and a question for Philip. So my comment on your talk, we discussed it in the break, but about the more is different issue. So there seems to be a little bit of confusion about the role of the thermodynamic limit and the large number of particles and so on. So I think the statement is that you need a large number of particles. That's a necessary condition, but not a sufficient one for emergent phenomena. Yeah. So that's the comment. Now, a question for Phil. So you gave a couple of conundrums, and the first conundrum you gave was the Hubbard model. And I wanted to ask you, and I thought it was a good example, and I wanted to ask you, where would you put in the sort of classification of things that we've talked about here, the Philip Phillips and Rob Lee's work on the Hubbard model, where they claim to be able to use sorts of string theory methods or whatever to relate the high energy and the low energy. And so in a sense, that's a kind of, perhaps a different category of theory than simple integrating out the high frequency degrees of freedom. So anyway, I'll give you an opportunity to talk a bit more about that issue.
Okay, so a number of us have thrown string theory methods at it. I wrote a paper with Gordon Semenoff attempting to do it. I am ashamed to say, and I just found this out from Rob Lee in the coffee break, that I'd read the earlier papers of Philip Phillips, where he had mistakenly attempted to argue that starting from the Anderson model, you did not get the right expansion for the TJ model. This was shown to be incorrect by André-Marie Tremblay. And I was not aware of the later papers. So he's actually, we decided that he would come to UBC so that we could talk about them.
Okay. So
I mean, obviously that addresses precisely the point that I was talking about. The point I was making is an old point, but I believe that any attempt to go for it is really important.
Right. But the interesting thing here is that what they were able to do was, I mean, they recognized exactly this conundrum that you want to try to get something in the low energy sector, but there's still a very subtle aspect of the high energy behavior that needs to be.
Yeah, no, I can't comment on those papers because I haven't seen them. Rob gave me a description of them, which made it sound as though that's exactly the problem they were addressing, and moreover, that they were addressing it in the context of ultraviolet infrared mixing free string theory.
Exactly.
I'm fascinated to hear more.
So I'm bringing that paper to everybody's attention. I think it's a paper that's worth looking at.
That was the real point of your question.
From the perspective of emergence, because it does give you. People here have been talking about renormalization group and the long wavelength limit and so on, but that's not the only game in town. And so
absolutely, and let me just add to that, the games in town that are making all the noise, the one that's making all the noise at this meeting is RG, etc. A lot of noise is made in other meetings by quantum critical people, but quite honestly, neither of them go anywhere near addressing the simple Hubbard model.
Yeah, I'd like to ask a question to everybody on stage and possibly others who off stage that really gets to the heart of my total perplexity about what is being argued about emergence. So I want to consider a simple example where my fundamental theory is a bunch of classical particles that have a very short range, very repulsive interactions between them. And now I take a lot of these particles, put them in a box, and I get the phenomena of sound waves out, right? And now sound waves is not something I can describe at the level of individual particles. To my mind, the sound waves are every bit as emergent a phenomena in this system as superconductivity is in the systems where superconductivity. I don't see any distinction. But of course, the sound waves, there's no quantum protectorates, there's no renormalization group, there's no all the other things that have been talked about as though at least, but it is a collective phenomena. Okay, so what I'd like to ask is basically a simple yes or no question to the people as to whether I should think of sound waves as an emergent phenomena in this system? And if the answer is no, then I'd like a couple of sentences as to why. And, you know, other people who've spoken, like Bob or whatever, if they can chime in too, that would be great.
If we all say really yes, like we can go more quickly to lunch.
Pressure's on. I would say yes in the way that physicists use the term emergence, no in the way that I'm using the term emergence, philosophers using the term emergence. Short answer is no, not emergent.
What's the why? What is it?
Because they're completely, the sound wave phenomena are completely predictable and
so
explainable. Okay, then that's not emergent either. Well, that's what philosophers believe, in physics anyway.
God can predict them all.
So, yeah.
I think it is emergent, but it's not always so simple, right? It's not emergent. Okay. So, I would like to...
I want to go to lunch.
yeah. Can I hear? I want to know. Yeah, okay.
I don't think the sound waves are emergent because, as I talked about in my talk, I think you have to have a notion of multi-stability. So you have to look at, you know, it's like the same question of what is a Goldstone mode. Well, a Goldstone mode is something that comes from the breaking of a continuous symmetry. So if you have a mode above the critical temperature and it's still there below the critical temperature, the fact that it exists above the critical temperature when there's no multi-stability says it's not associated with the symmetry breaking. So I would say that a sound wave, a simple sound wave, is something that happens in a state where there's no emergent order. It's not a property. It's a collective property. It's a long wave. It's a long wavelength collective property, but that doesn't mean that it's emergent. So there are modes that are also have acoustic spectrum below the point where an emergent state arises, and those modes are emergent. That's the example I gave in my talk. The transverse, the shear mode, the transverse phonons in a solid. Those would be emergent. So there's a difference between the longitudinal sound waves that are always there, above and below the transition.
In a situation where there's no distinction between longitudinal and transverse, how would you handle that intermediate situation?
Well, then you haven't got a continuous symmetry. So
so my answer is the same as Nigel's, what he said. No, seriously, though, I think that's why I think the notion of protectorate is important here, to try and distinguish between collective phenomena and other kinds of phenomena that exhibit stability
some
in different ways.
We're nearing the end of a lot of time. Let's have one last question, and we can keep talking later. There's more discussion.
It's more a comment than a question. In fact, I'm surprised that no one discussed at all biology, because biology, after all, is part of the physical world, and some of the phenomena of biology are of physical nature. And in biology, you see at evidence where emergent phenomena are. I'm also an experimentalist, so I have a different point of view on this. I think, for me, emergence means that the robust phenomenon emerges at a different scale. So, and this robustness idea, or maybe it's very usually linked with a mathematical universality. Yeah. And this has not been pointed out here, I think. You know, for instance, if you do work in pattern formation, you find the same phenomenon in crystal growth, in viscous fingering, in plant growth. And of course, if you look at the macrostructure, it's completely different. So if you look at plant growth, you generate spirals and you generate something that looks like a quasi-crystal. And of course, it's not a biologist approach doesn't lead to this idea of quasi-crystal, but if you have a physical point of view, you see that from the growth of plants emerges a structure which is a quasi-crystal. So from this point, that's what I understand as. So I don't know if it's correct from either the physicist point of view or physical point of view, but that's my point.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an interesting issue, the relationship, too, between physics and biology, because, you know, population genetics grew out of, I mean, Fisher's... account of population genetics grew out of his views about statistical mechanics and the second law and the fundamental, the relationship between the second law of thermodynamics and the fundamental theorem. So you get these very strong mathematical analogies in population genetics over from physics. So there those kinds of connections are very important. So I think, but I think one of the problems is that we're all philosophers of physics, and so you probably need to get a philosopher of biology in here to give you the broad view. The
why are philosophers getting more specialized than scientists?
Yeah.
That's a good question. Okay, let's thank this morning's speakers.